Welcome to episode 66 of the Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast. We are glad you've joined us. My name is John Fia. I am your host of the podcast. We have our studio producer, Casey Lehman, behind the glass, and we are really excited about today's episode. Our guest is going to be Serena Zabin. You'll hear from her in a second. I first met Serena when we were both history graduate students. She was at Rutgers, and I was at Stony Brook, but we would often chat at events sponsored by the McNeil Center for Early American Studies at Penn. I've watched her career flourish at Carleton College, one of the best liberal arts colleges in the country. Last year, we got a chance to catch up over coffee while I was in Northfield, Minnesota, to talk to faculty about blogging and public scholarship at both Carleton and St. Olaf College there in Northfield. They have a joint program there. And it was during that meeting that I learned about her latest book project. As Serena told me about her project, The Boston Massacre, A Family History, I knew we had to have her on the podcast. While several historians and writers, including Hiller Zobel, Richard Archer, and Eric Hinderrocker, have written about the Boston Massacre, Zabin brings her skills as a social historian to bear on this important revolutionary event. Through her gifted prose and storytelling, we see the British military occupation of Boston through the eyes of the soldiers and their wives and children, many of whom arrived in the city after months in the wilds of Nova Scotia, Canada. We learn about the webs of friendship and neighborliness forged between these families and the people of Boston. We get a vivid glimpse of their physical surroundings and their social world. And in the process, Serena Zabin forces us to think about this moment in our revolutionary past in new ways. On March 5, 1770, the day of the so-called Boston Massacre, the city of Boston experienced a social revolution that precipitated the larger political revolution that we are all familiar with. If you are a fan of the American Revolution, or someone who has visited Boston's Freedom Trail, or someone who simply enjoys hearing the real human stories behind some of the events that have come to define our shared history as Americans, I think you will enjoy this interview. Serena will join us in a moment, but first, let's take care of some business. The Way of Improvement Leads Home podcast is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. When you get a chance, head over to recordedhistory.net to check out some of our fellow network podcasts. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is brought to you through the generous donations of Lisa DeGuardi, Richard Green, Ron Schooler, Kate Logan, Margaret Graves, Gretchen Adams, and Bob Beatty. And as always, thanks to Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. We are a listener-supported podcast, and we keep things going by your generous financial donations. If you like what you hear and you want to support our work, please head over to thewayofimprovement.com and click support, or go directly to our Patreon page at patreon.com, that's patreon.com/thewayofimprovement. And the best way to spread the word about the podcast is to tell a friend. You can follow us at TWOILH Podcast on Twitter and on Facebook. If you like an episode, give us a share or a retweet and consider a positive review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, and Stitcher. And now on to our guest. Serena Zabin is professor of history, Broom Fellow for Public Scholarship, and director of American Studies at Carleton College in Northfield, Minnesota. She is the author of Dangerous Economies, Status and Commerce in Imperial New York, published in 2009 with the University of Pennsylvania Press, and the New York Conspiracy Trials of 1741, Daniel Horsmenden's Journal of the Proceedings, published in 2004 as part of the Bedford series in History and Culture. She is also the co-designer of a video game about the Boston Massacre titled Witness to the Revolution. Our interview today is based on her most recent book, The Boston Massacre, A Family History, published in 2020 with Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Publishing. Let's talk a little bit then about the content of the book. Obviously, the Boston Massacre is a seminal event in the coming of the American Revolution, especially in New England. There have been a lot of books written about the Boston Massacre, and a lot of books cover the Boston Massacre, even though the words, right, Boston Massacre may not appear in the title. So make the case, you know, why is your book unique? What kind of angle are you bringing to the story that no one else has brought before? And tell us a little bit how you conceived such a work.
So my book is actually called The Boston Massacre, A Family History. So what I do really differently that nobody's noticed before is to think about families and to think about families in two ways, to understand and explain and show to people something that we've never really paid attention to or recognized for reasons that I'll talk about. We've never really recognized the ways in which families were a part of the world around what comes to be known as the Boston Massacre. So the British military that comes to Boston in 1768 is a family institution that brings with it women and children. They travel together around the British Empire. So when troops come to Boston in 1768, they come with hundreds of women and children, and those people are part of the story. And as well as the many Bostonians who become part of military families, sometimes actually by, say, marrying in, and that certainly happened, mm-hmm. and sometimes in ways that we might think of as fictive families, for example, when military families asked their local neighbors to act as godparents for their new children, right? They turn those Bostonians into parts of their larger family. So that story of what happens when civilians and military get together, live on the streets of Boston together, and make families together is a story that we haven't known at all. And that story then helps us see a bigger story about the place that the Boston Massacre has in the coming of the American Revolution. So we've thought about it ever since Daniel Webster, I think, said this somewhere early in the 19th century, and John Adams and some others said the same, that the Boston Massacre was the first bloodshed of the American Revolution. And so later, after the revolution's over, it comes to be known as the beginning of the end. It's the beginning of the revolution. But the way I see it and what happens with these families is that the Boston Massacre ends up breaking up these actual families, these military families, as troops move and are moved out of Boston after the shooting. But they also help break down the larger idea of the British Empire as a family. So when the American Revolution begins, it begins not, I think, with this big bang, but with what I think of as the breakdown of the family, the breakdown of the imperial family. So I actually refer to the Boston Massacre as less a political event and a little more as a messy divorce.
Now, is it fair to say that maybe you're writing about maybe revolution is too strong of a term, I don't know, but a sort of social revolution, social change happening within a sort of larger political revolution?
I think that, you know, in the 18th century, the ideas of family and ideas of the political state are actually pretty closely intertwined ideas in which the king is a father in certain ways, right? And so the division between the idea of a private domestic family and a larger political world isn't very sharp. Right. Yeah. And so, yes, I think the breakdown of that family is a political event, and it's also a deeply personal event.
Yeah.
And because it's a personal event, the political event feels sharper.
I don't know about you, but you know, I tell my first year history majors, right? Revolution is a significant change, right, of some type. And clearly, pre and post March 5th, 1770, there's something that changes after March 5th, 1770 that could be conceived as some type of a revolution happening, right? In terms of the way ordinary lives are transformed or relationships changed and so forth.
That's right. Although I would say it's also true that the night of March 5th, when the shooting happens, it doesn't change everything all at once. It's the beginning of a set of changes. Right. But it doesn't mark the absolute end of an era. The story I wanted to tell is that this world of families that were made between the military and civilians turns out to be a story that lots of political people, both the Sons of Liberty and the military officers and governor's party who are all in Boston, are trying to erase. They want us in the future, and their audience at the time, they want us not to see that story. So we've erased that world of connection between civilians and the military, which is why it was forgotten. But it was there. There was just a deliberate attempt to do kind of a sleight of hand to divert our attention elsewhere so we wouldn't notice all of those connections.
Now, is that something that happened in the later historiography or writing about the Boston Massacre, or was something that happened at the time?
It happens at the time. It happens really as soon as it's a piece of that very, very famous Revere engraving. It is a piece of the pamphlets that both sides are publishing, and it's a piece of the trials that come out the following fall. They are already in the process of trying to assign blame. They are busy trying to kind of wash away connections, evidence of the connections between the soldiers and the civilians, because it doesn't fit very well in a story of blame.
Let's try to unpack this, all of what you just said, a little bit more. So you write that the quartering of British soldiers in Boston created a, quote, a fundamental shift in the relationships between colonial and imperial, between citizen and soldier. So tell us a little bit more, maybe offer some detail about what did that shift in relationships look like. You've already talked a little bit about this, but give us some sort of examples or maybe a story here or there about how these relationships changed. Like, what is your evidence to support this?
When the troops come to Boston, the hope from the governor, who's the one who's asking for troops to serve as a kind of police force to back up his own governmental authority, his hope is that they will be living and quartered right in the center of Boston, right? Practically at his doorstep underneath the old State House, what's now the old State House, so that he can call on them to kind of support him and awe people into doing his bidding and that of the imperial government. He wants them right there. The problem is that Massachusetts had just renovated barracks right in the middle of Boston Harbor. They had renovated them for the Seven Years' War a few years earlier. They'd raised taxes to do that. They thought they were rather nice barracks. And the Quartering Act insisted that if there were available barracks, troops had to be quartered there first. If they're not barracks, then they could be quartered in public houses. That's why they're called public houses, but we know them now as bars and pubs. And only if neither of those two were available could private homes be requisitioned. So they have an impasse because the barracks that exist are out in Boston Harbor. That's about a seven-mile hike in, or a three-mile row through a rather narrow channel. And the governor is quite clear that having troops so far away is not going to serve his purposes. And the Boston selectmen are quite clear that if the army and the governor insist on violating the Quartering Act, they will have them cashiered and kicked out of the army. So the compromise that they come up with is to have the army rent spaces from Bostonians. So they do rent a few warehouses, few empty warehouses that they turn into little barracks, but basically they mostly end up finding some empty houses and then people's spare rooms and their basements and their sheds and whatever extra space Bostonians have, they end up renting to the army. So in fact, instead of being kind of isolated in a little, what we might think of as like a green zone, if we were thinking about, mm-hmm. you know, the war in Iraq or something, the army is scattered along with these families throughout the entire square mile of the Boston Peninsula. So that means now Bostonians were finding soldiers as their neighbors. So they would occasionally send their kids over in the kind of 18th century equivalent of borrowing a cup of sugar. You know, mm-hmm. they would send their kids over to borrow some coal to start their fire again. They would, you know, as I said, they married locals. They had dances with locals. They occasionally committed larceny with locals. All of those things mm-hmm. happen as they get to know each other and are living, literally living together all around the entire town of Boston.
What you're arguing then is that it's hard for those relationships to be looked at anything but a kind of just human beings interacting in a small space, right? They sort of transcend the political identities, yeah. right, that exist between imperial and local.
That's exactly right. They transcend them and they're interwoven in them both. But yeah, those yeah. relationships are complicated. As you say, they're human relationships. So sometimes they're hostile and sometimes people are peeved at each other and right. sometimes they're very warm. And sometimes within the same family, they might be both. So one of my favorite stories is about a private, a soldier who ends up having an affair with and then eventually marrying the granddaughter of one of the more elderly Sons of Liberty. Mm-hmm. And throughout this whole slightly elaborate story that involves a lot of conflict, the soldier quite clearly thinks of this as, you know, kind of an escapade, although he's also getting married, you know, and he's really thinking about his own personal life. But when the newspapers get hold of this story, they see it as political. They understand right. seduction as literally, and from the Latin root, the drawing away from this, as the breaking up of families. So, well, people who are politically astute or are politically aware sometimes look at these relationships and understand them in political terms, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes even those people just see them as social.
Yeah, yeah. So we have these kinds of networks. You know, it sounds like, you know, sort of some kind of social capital, to use a modern term, is being built up among these communities, mm-hmm. These neighborhoods where soldiers and colonials, Bostonians, are meeting. There's moments of tension. There's also moments of kind of, you know, neighborliness mm-hmm. and these kinds of things. And then it's much more complicated than the way we're making it here in the podcast. But then March 5th, 1770 comes.
Right.
You have the British soldiers in front of the customs house shooting. Five Bostonians are dead. You have all of the melee and the drama associated with that. It kind of rocks the city of Boston.
Absolutely.
And you interpret this, you interpret it in a variety of ways, but one of the phrases you use caught my attention, right? That event transformed neighbors into strangers. Tell me a little bit more about that.
Right. When that event happens, when soldiers shoot civilians in front of really the seat of power, it's true, the soldiers are in front of the customs house, but the Bostonians pretty much die right in front of yeah. what's, as I said, now the old state house, right? So the yeah. kind of central power of government. At that moment, they are neighbors. They all know each other pretty well. You know, I mean, not every single yeah. person, but someone on the street that night knows each of those soldiers. Those soldiers all know at least some of the Bostonians on the street. They know each other. They are neighbors together. But over time, over the next few weeks, yeah. The gears of what's going to happen both legally and politically kind of grind into motion. So on the one mm-hmm. level, on the social level, stuff doesn't change that quickly. In fact, half the marriages I found in the Boston churches happened after March 5th, 1770. So yeah. it's not, as I said, it's not a sea change that happens, but
And this would be half the marriages between British soldiers and...
Yeah, thank you. Yes. So half the marriages between British soldiers and Boston women happened after the shooting. So it's not as though somehow soldiers become anathema, right? That's not precisely what happens. But they start to seem like people who are not sharing homes, who are not sharing families, who are not sharing also various nefarious deeds. Not to everyone, but in these legal and political processes. So it starts with the Revere engraving that so clearly shows soldiers on the one side of the street and civilians on the other. And that's an argument about who's at blame, where clearly the soldiers are at fault for shooting these innocent, middle-class, unarmed civilians. Meanwhile, though, as people are preparing for these trials and they're collecting all of these depositions about what happened, the depositions are taken partly because people are horrified and want to bear witness to what happened, but they're arranged in part to show that this was premeditated violence, that people have been hearing threats made by soldiers against civilians or vice versa. And as they did that, they start to ignore all of the evidence that actually is still embedded in these depositions, but the evidence of the connection between soldiers and civilians. So, of course, in order to make a threat to someone, you actually have to somehow be with them, be present, be in their face. Yeah. So there's lots of evidence that says, oh, all these people are sitting around in the same kitchen drinking when they hear these threats. But the emphasis increasingly is on the threats and less around the sitting around together.
When I think of that Revere, just the sort of pedagogy thing here, when I think of that Revere engraving, you know, I usually use it in class to illustrate, you know, propaganda.
Absolutely.
It got passed down through all the other colonies and so forth. Or maybe I'll use it to illustrate this kind of Whig idea of the sort of, you know, fear of standing armies, right? This is what happens, you know, especially in a survey class when you have like 2 minutes to talk about the Boston Massacre. But in many ways, if I hear you correctly, right, that image also represents the kind of breaking down of these kinds of family stories or these cross, what do we want to call them, soldier, local kind of stories in that sense, right?
Yeah. I mean, we get so fixated. It's so obvious to us, the propaganda piece where Revere has relabeled customs houses Butcher's Hall, right?
Yeah.
Or, you know, you can see the captain Preston behind the soldiers waving them on with his sword.
Right.
It's so obvious what the propaganda is that we haven't looked at the other piece of storytelling that's embedded in that, which is that there's this big divide between soldiers and civilians, but that's part of the story he's telling also. And we've just forgotten it.
You feel, though, that Revere is trying to tell this same story as well, you feel?
Yeah, I think all the Sons of Liberty are. It's part of the narrative of the Sons of Liberty. And one of the things that I think we've kind of forgotten, that maybe I underplay a little bit in the book, is that the Sons of Liberty are sons, right? It's an all-men's group.
Yeah.
And they have a particular story that they want to tell about, as you say, absolutely about standing army, about, you know, unbridled power, but also about their own inability sometimes to control their female dependents. But if we remember that actually Boston has a large number of unmarried women, partly because so many young men are killed in the Seven Years' War, from the women's perspective, when soldiers come to Boston, they look like pretty good marriage material. They don't get to tell that story, right? Only the Sons of Liberty get to tell theirs.
That's fascinating. I will never look at the Boston Massacre in the same way.
Thank
after
you.
Reading your
that
book.
Was my goal.
Let's talk about, I actually had a guest on last week, and I won't get into the details, but he kind of brought up the trial.
Oh.
And it was in a completely different context. We were actually talking about the rule of law and how, you know, people actually abided by the rule of law. He brought up the famous HBO miniseries, right, on John Adams, which starts with the trial, which I'm sure you're familiar with. You do spend some time talking about this trial. And I think if anybody knows anything about the trial, I think the first thing or the only thing they know is like that John Adams, right, defended the shooters and, you know, the irony of that and so forth. But you write that the real importance of the trial of these soldiers, again, for killing five Bostonians, you say, quote, clarified very little about what had happened on March 5th, 1770. And then you go on, the true importance of the Boston Massacre trials is to be found in what they managed to conceal. Explain that.
Right. So the trials, yes, as we know, become a real touchstone for American sense of themselves, absolutely for the Massachusetts Bar Association. They spend a lot of time quoting John Adams on these things. And I'm happy to talk afterwards about what I think is his actual brilliant legal strategy here, legal and political strategy, because it was difficult. But what it manages to conceal these trials, right, is not the same thing as what they reveal. So I would say that for 250 years, really some of the finest legal minds and historical minds ever have tried to figure out what happened on the night of March 5th, 1770. Starting with Adams himself, tries to put together a story for the jury to follow, and then many, many lawyers and scholars and judges after that have tried to understand this one central question, which is, how did this happen? Whose fault was it? They spend a lot of time looking at blame, because that's actually the appropriate legal question, right? Like, the question was, you know, did Captain Preston give the order to fire? Were the soldiers actually appropriately firing in self-defense? Those are the two legal questions on which the trials hinge. And so, of course, that's the kind of thing that Revere is trying to get at. He's trying to get at questions of blame. But by doing so, he actually covers over, in order to make an argument about blame, he covers over these stories of connection. So one of the things that I found most interesting about these trials is that Adams calls to the stand as a defense witness for the captain, a woman who was known as Jane Crothers at the time of the shooting. She was on the street that night. She was talking to the sentry. She's an eyewitness. And she gives pretty strong, definitive defense, a statement that Captain Preston did not say the word fire. She said she could see his mouth, did not shape those words. And the prosecution doesn't question this witness, lets her statement stand. There seems to be no problem. It turns out that in the months between the shooting and the trial, this woman, Jane, actually had married a soldier. She's not a disinterested party. I told the story last night to, I think, three former DAs and the current DA of Massachusetts, and they're all kind of horrified, right? Of Suffolk County. I said, oh my gosh, right? That's not a thing you can let go. But they, at the time, it was better actually for both sides not to acknowledge these marriages between local women and soldiers than it was even to try to win this case. It was more important that people just look the other way. And throughout, there's lots of evidence about how these people know each other, and much of that is accepted into testimony, but nobody questions that as a problem for the case.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And then you add, also talking about the trial then, and I think you've kind of alluded to this a little bit in our interview here. I love the wordplay here. You suggest that the trial then turns a shooting, right, which happens on March 5th, 1770, on, was it King Street in Boston, into a massacre,
right?
And then you say it smooths the path to the American Revolution in Boston.
Yeah, exactly. So until actually people, both soldiers and civilians, or especially I would say the kind of governor and his party and those people who come to be known as the Liberty Party, until they can definitively convince themselves that they really are two different peoples on two different sides, you really have a hard time getting to revolution. And what the trials do and what the renaming of the shooting as a massacre does is it makes that line much wider. It separates those two sides. And that needs to happen. All the forgetting of these relationships needs to happen before actually anyone can get to revolution, to separation.
Yeah. Right. Tell our listeners, when does it become the Boston Massacre?
It becomes the Boston Massacre very soon thereafter. Right. So Revere's engraving comes out in about 3 weeks, and he's already entitled it the Boston Massacre, as does the pamphlet of Bostonians' depositions that comes out just a couple of months after that, a month and a half. Right. And that also is called A Short Narrative of the Horrid Massacre. So the name comes up quickly. And indeed, the whole idea at whenever soldiers shoot civilians anywhere in the British Empire, including in London, which happened in 1768, it is known as a massacre. That's part of the political language. So in 1768, soldiers right in the heart of London shot civilians in an event that comes to be known as the Massacre of St. George's Field, right? But that's not a story we know very well. It doesn't become a political moment. So when I say it becomes a massacre, it's not just named massacre. It becomes something that means to people, oh, this is the power of the imperial state that's completely out of hand.
Right, right. I mean, you could call it a shooting. Would you use any kind of adjectives to describe, like, is it a, the way you're sort of laying it out, right? It's like a neighborhood conflict or a domestic situation gone bad, or I don't know if that's the right way. It seems like that's what you're suggesting, right? This was a conflict between people who were deeply connected. And then, as illustrated by Revere in the engraving, right, it becomes a political massacre, so to speak.
Yes. I mean, I do think that, of course, this is a conflict between neighbors. I think that's important for us to know.
Right.
It's not, I do not believe that it is premeditated.
Right.
That said, I think that the conditions for shooting were all in place. And everybody knew it. So, in fact, the army is being sent throughout peacetime in the 18th century, is continually being used to do this kind of urban policing, right? So there's a standing army, even though all Britons understand that a standing army is a terrible thing. But they use the standing army to put down riots, to try to catch smugglers, which is happening all over Britain, not just in North America. And this kind of urban policing is something that soldiers are not trained to do, but it seems like a kind of cost-efficient use of this army that the parliament doesn't want to disband completely. So whenever officers learn that they are going to be sent to do this kind of urban work, they immediately want out. They understand that the likelihood of a civilian shooting becomes very high the minute you have patrols in a crowded place where, you know, soldiers have guns and civilians are not happy about having, you know, more people squished into their space, especially men are not very happy about that. The likelihood for conflict is high. So when officers learn they're being sent to Boston, many of them start petitioning for home leave. They understand that this could ruin their careers. So I think nobody is in some ways surprised when this happens. It feels inevitable, not because the conflicts were so great, but because structurally speaking, this is what happens when you use the army to do police work.
Or when you have a lot of guns in a small little area, right?
Yes, and guns are part of it.
For a moment there, I thought you were making an argument against the Second Amendment or against the NRA. Some of your words sounded like that, but it's true.
I mean, I don't want to say that the fact that soldiers had guns and civilians didn't is what caused this, because I don't think it did.
Yeah, sure.
But I do think the fact that you have a lot more guns in Boston at this moment than you did, you know, any other time since, you know, the Seven Years' War and then in the years before it, explains why there are really no other shootings in Boston with the exception of a couple of accidents, right? I mean,
I won't push you any further in that direction, Serena.
Thank you.
So we got a few more minutes here left. Let me just wrap it up. Your epilogue is entitled Civil War. And those of you who have been listening so far to the interview, you may be able to now predict how Serena will answer this question. But how was then the American Revolution, as viewed through the lens of Boston, then a civil war?
So it's a civil war, or sometimes I even think of it as a sibling war, right? That it
You use that
Yes, I
term,
use that
yeah.
term too because I found so many siblings actually who are split by this war and these events. So it is actually still, I think, a war between people who see each other as essentially part of the same family. So the term civil war for us, of course, always means the American Civil War, in which we think about brother
Right,
against
right.
brother. Here, I think what we see is a lot of sister against sister. So
Yeah.
when soldiers are redeployed, the women that married them have choices to make. Sometimes soldiers desert so they can stay with their new families. Sometimes women decide that they're not going to go with the army, and so they end up self-divorcing and remarrying eventually in Massachusetts. But they have an ex-husband who is now part of an army traveling around the empire. And of course, many of them leave. And when they leave, it's like little shards of Boston embedded in the British army traveling around the empire. And so when the army comes back, even if it's not precisely the same regiment, precisely the same people, it ends up being an institution that is somehow shot through with the very people that they are about to shoot.
Great stuff. If someone wants to learn more about the book or about you or maybe where you're speaking and those kinds of things, do you have a website, Serena?
I do serenazabin.com.
SerenaZabin.com. Check it out. I'm assuming the books are widely available
Absolutely.
at all the usual places. Get out there and buy a copy. Say, what holiday do we have? We usually pitch a St. Patrick's Day gift.
St. Patrick's Day gift. It starts with Ireland. We should start with St. Patrick's Day.
That's
Yes.
right.
Yep.
That's right. Perfect. We can pitch it that way. Thanks so much, Serena. We've been talking with Serena Zabin. She is the author of a brand new book, The Boston Massacre, A Family History. Go out and get a copy of it. And thanks for your time.
Thank you so much, John. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Have a great day. I've known Serena and watched her career, as I mentioned in the opening, for a long time, and was just thrilled to be able to interview her today. This book, if you really are looking for a good read, if you're an academic or a history graduate student or even a college history student, get a copy of this. This is one of those wonderful books that can be read by both academics, history buffs, but also sort of general readers. It's a wonderful story about families, about love, about marriage, about sex, about how to get along with people that are different or how to deal with strangers in your neighborhood. So there's a lot of really, really good history here, and it's told in such a very, very compelling way. As I said to Serena in the interview, I'm not sure I will ever teach the Boston Massacre the same after reading her book. And if you are a professor, this would be a wonderful book to assign to students. It works, I think, really, really well. And it would work really, really well, I think, with students. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. I know I did. We will be back with another one shortly. And until we meet again, may your way of improvement always lead home.
This has been a production of The Way of Improvement Leads Home, a blog dedicated to reflections at the intersection of American history, religion, politics, and academic life. Visit us at thewayofimprovement.com. The Way of Improvement Leads Home is a member of the Recorded History Podcast Network. Check out other podcasts on the network by heading over to recordedhistory.net. If you want to support our efforts, please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcatcher of choice so others may more easily find this podcast. And let's continue the conversation on Facebook and Twitter. Follow us at TWOILH Podcast. The podcast was brought to you through the generous support of Gretchen Adams, Richard Green, Margaret Graves, Kate Logan, Lisa DeGuardi, Ron Schooler, and Bob Beatty. Also, many thanks to our sponsor, Jennings College Consulting, discovering the right college fit for your future. The podcast was recorded at the High Center Recording Studios in Messiah College. Thanks to Ed Ark for his continued support. Original music is by Overholt. Many thanks to our guest, Jeffrey Engel. I've been your studio engineer and producer, Casey Lehman, and your host, as always, is John Fia.
Grand Canyon University makes earning your degree possible with over 130 academic programs for traditional campus students, with more than 80 bachelor's programs offered online. GCU provides you with the personal support you need, from complimentary unofficial transcript evaluations within 24 business hours to scholarships, academic support, and your GCU graduation team, led by your own university counselor. Find your purpose at GCU. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.